Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where every time we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, we want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. Along the way, learn a thing or two. And we remind you each week that no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who've done things maybe you can't even imagine for the sake of our freedom. This week, we mark the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. It didn't end the way most wars end. We'll talk about that. But this is the 60th anniversary, so I thought we'd focus on Korea. And a lot of people don't know too much about the Korean War, the Korean conflict, as some might refer to it. One place you can go to learn a lot about it is the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno. And if you're lucky, you might run into a docent there by the name of Fred Machado. We're going to hear from Fred today. Although they didn't call you Fred back in the Azores. Fernando Machado grew up speaking Portuguese on the Azore Islands, huh?
That is correct. That's the first language I learned, how to speak Portuguese. And when I was 16 years old when I came to the United States, I did immigrate. I was born an American citizen. My dad was an American citizen. But we lived there with everybody else, and I was 16 when I came, and at 18 I joined the Navy.
So you already had family back here?
Lots of family back here. Yeah, my uncles, aunts, and many relatives here.
So, and as I look at your wall, there are all kinds of mementos to your long career in agriculture and the dairy business. You're on the board of the Danish Creamery for many years. You're the president of the Fresno County Farm Bureau for a while. A lot of people in the agricultural community know you. But let's go back to that teenager that comes over, and maybe even before that, because I ask every World War II veteran about Pearl Harbor Day, because he was in the States at the time. You're in Portugal when World War II broke out, or at least in the Azores. So what kind of awareness of this worldwide war did you have while that was going on?
Well, we were very aware of the war, because one thing, my dad was here at that time. He came over here in 1939. He got a letter from the American Consul that as an American citizen, he needed to come to the United States because the world wasn't stable at that time. So we were all small kids, and at that time, the Germans were already sinking every ship that crossed the ocean. There were no airplanes flying across the Atlantic in those days. And so we stayed there, and they came over here. And naturally, we kept up what was going on. We knew there was a big war going on. But in those islands, in those days, they were kind of isolated. It was not an everyday occurrence. However, first the British, then the United States, together with the British, built a huge Air Force base in one of the islands in the Azores. And that base is still in operation today, a U.S. Air Force base. In the island of Terceira, it's called Lajes Air Force Base.
So that must have been something as a kid to see these big airplanes going over.
Right, that is correct. It was something just used to see them flying over all the time, and it was my dream to be a pilot someday, although I never been in the service. I did because a private pilot later.
Was it a big deal to you guys out on the Azores when World War II was over? Was that something that mattered to you?
Yes. The thing is that my dad was waiting for the war to be over so we could bring the whole family over, and naturally we were looking forward to it. It was a great day the day I arrived in this country. I feel that was the day that I was born.
Well, and anyone who's ever been by your property in Fresno can tell how much of a patriot you are. You've got a replica of the Statue of Liberty in your yard, the American flag, the Navy flag. I think there's one that says One Nation Under God, and a big cross, and even an elephant. You must be a Republican, huh?
I've been a Republican all my life, and I still have a lot of faith in the Republican Party, and I do everything I can to elect honest men and women with the dignity, with dedicated to the greatness of our country, and this is what we need, my friend.
And you said that the day you came to this country felt like the day you were born. What was it that you expected? What made that such a special day for you?
Well, I knew that when I got here that I had opportunities that I would never had in those islands where I was born. The day was going to come when I was going to get out of there because I was an American citizen. But coming as a young man like I did with my brothers and sisters, seven of us, and my mother, my dad was already here, I knew that the opportunities were immense. And I knew that I was going to have a chance to make something of myself if I wanted to. And I took advantage. God's been good to me. I married a wonderful lady. We have 3 children, 6 grandchildren, and I had a total of nothing when I started in business. I started farming on a piece of rented property with the money that I saved in my 4 years in the Navy. I bought my first car when I got out of the Navy. I bought a used tractor and a disc and a cultivator and rented 25 acres of land, and that's how I got started. And today, we own about 830 acres or so of land. We're diversified. We have grapes, almonds, and we're about to plant some pistachios. And we were in the dairy business for 40 years, but we've been out of the dairy business for the last 4.
Well, and why do I have a feeling that when you came here as a 16-year-old, you had to milk some cows out here in California?
Absolutely. That was the first job, was milking cows.
That's why you got in the Navy so fast, I guess, huh?
That is correct. And as a matter of fact, when you go in the Navy, in those days, they ask you, what did you do outside? I said, I milk cows. That's what we did. Yes, we did milk cows for different people. I picked cotton, I picked grapes, I done everything. And I never resented any of it, because I knew someday I'm going to be the guy that's going to own these things. And in this blessed country, there's no limit to what you can do.
So your feeling was something like that, something like what you have today, even though you proudly in your office here next to the Stars and Stripes and the California flag, you've got the Portuguese flag, I see it there, but you felt like what you've achieved here wouldn't have been possible back home?
Absolutely not. It would not have been possible anywhere else in the world, what we've achieved here. This is a great, unbelievable, great country.
So what was it as a teenager that made you decide, you know what, I want to serve in the Navy?
Well, I was 18 years old when the Korean War broke out. And I still was having a little tough time speaking English. I did speak English, but that was not to my liking. The Korean War broke out on June 25th, 1950. I remember that day, as plain as day, was a Sunday. And I knew I was going to go into service. And I waited until November. And then I joined the Navy. There were so many people going into service at that time. I joined the Navy, 2 other fellows here from Fresno with me. And we wanted to leave right away. And they said, you'll leave next week. Okay, a week later, we get a call, said, no, there's too many. It's going to be January before you leave. Came January, they said, it's going to be March before you leave. And finally in March, 1 week after I turned 19, I left. And I got to boot camp. And my draft papers came in the mail over here in Fresno, and my folks sent them back saying that I was already in the service. I knew I had to do my share to help preserve the liberty, the freedom, the democracies, and the greatness of our nation.
Well, and I think everyone hearing you say that can tell that you wouldn't have backed down from any challenge. But have you ever wondered, had you not gone in on your own and chosen the Navy, how maybe your Korean War experience might have been a little different?
Absolutely. It might have been altogether different, because I would have gone one way or the other. I could have had been in the Navy. Not naturally, the Army would have drafted me, but I could have joined the Marine Corps. A friend of mine at that time joined the Marines. He said, let's go to the Marines. I said, no, I'm going to try the Navy. And he got shot up pretty bad in Korea, and he has passed away, by the way. But, it could have been altogether different. But I'm proud of the Navy. I spent 4 years in the Navy. I was on a troop ship. We took many, many troops to Korea and cargo, because that's the type of ship that I was on. We take tanks and trucks and jeeps and all their ammunition, gasoline, and we made trip after trip. We got over there my first time in November of 51. And Christmas of 51, we were in Japan. I remember very well where I was that day. And then in January, we went to Korea, and we made military trips back and forth. And then March of 52, things got pretty hot in Korea. I think every ship that was in the Far East was called to Korea. We patrolled the coast up and down. We picked up some wounded Marines, because my ship was an AKA. What we did, we carried 24 landing craft on board. So these boats that many people have seen hit the beach, drop the ramp, and let the troops out, or drive your tanks and things out of there. That's what we did. We did that many times. And we did a lot of practicing. Of course, we were continuously practicing, always prepared to go to war.
And the ship you're talking about, an AKA, so an attack cargo ship.
Attack cargo amphibious is what it stands for.
What were your specific duties on that ship?
Well, for people with the Navy, they'll understand I was a boatswain's mate. I started out at the bottom, as you would do, come out of boot camp, paint boats and paint the ship and drive one of those boats to the beach. And finally, as I climbed up in rate in 4 years that I was there, I made a second-class boatswain's mate, which is a pay grade E5. It's the same in all branches of the service. In the Army would be a sergeant, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force as well. Coast Guard would be the same as the Navy. When I got to be third class, my work, I was more of a supervisor. In second class, I was really a supervisor. And when I left the ship, there were 10 people under me. I was in charge of a certain area of the ship, and I had a great career. I enjoyed the Navy.
I can tell. I can tell. And I think everybody listening can tell, too, which is great. And you talk about being a bosun's mate. You don't still have a bosun's whistle or anything, do you?
I do have a bosun's whistle. I do have my dog tags. And I do have my uniform. However, the uniform, I think it shrunk. I'm not able to.
I've heard similar stories from other veterans.
I tried to put it on, but it won't go.
You mentioned picking up some wounded soldiers, but so basically what you guys were doing the whole time you're over in Korea is transporting troops and supplies back and forth. What was that like interacting with all those troops? And did you ever have that feeling, well, you know, easily that could be me that's going ashore and not staying on the ship?
I remember that very well. And I remember one particular time when we had a group of soldiers aboard. And on the way, the ocean got pretty rough. And they got sick. They were sick. They say sicker than the heck. And I remember this one soldier telling me, I don't know who he was, but he said, "You guys could have this Navy. I'll take my foxhole any day." And I said, well, thank the Lord that I'm here. You know, I watched them go down the cargo net, and I took men to shore on a boat like everybody else. We had 24 boats, so you know, but I always came back. And when I got back aboard ship, I had a warm meal, take a shower, and a warm bed to sleep in. I said, thank God that I'm here.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to take that for granted when you see all those guys right in front of you that don't get that, huh?
That is correct. And you see some of them that went and never came back. And that was the sad thought. One thought that I always had coming back, when we came back to the States, 3 different trips I made overseas. But coming back to the States and see the coast of California, see the port of San Diego, they're coming into that beautiful bay. And one time we came into San Francisco after 11 months overseas. And see the Golden Gate, it kind of brings tears to your eyes. And at the same time, but they're tears of joy. Same times they can turn into tears of sadness because you think of those that didn't come home.
I think everyone can hear the emotion in your voice. This is real for you. And you knew some of those guys who didn't come home. And, you know, the Korean War, here's 60 years now since it ended, and they call it the Forgotten War. Now, one of the things that you do is you help keep the memory alive. You volunteer at the Legion of Valor, the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. How long have you been doing that?
I'm on my fourth year of doing that, and I enjoy it, and I love to explain to people what the museum stands for, what we do. I'm real concerned that we have failed in teaching history in our schools to our young people. There's people coming there and think, when did the Korean War happen? They don't have a clue. And we are the forgotten war. You know, we lost 54,000 lives over there. And it's sad that young people today don't have any idea what the Korean War was all about. Some of them don't even know what World War II was all about. And this is sad. We're teaching the wrong things to our kids in school. We need to get down to basics, to history, to teach what made this country great. People that are out there, they think that they just deserve this. Sure, they deserve it, but there's a lot of sacrifices made to keep it the way it is.
So if someone visits the museum, and by the way, the Veterans Memorial Museum is open every day, Monday through Saturday, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. There are great displays about a lot of military history, but specific to the Korean War. I know one of the things they'll see over there is a picture of the ship you were on, the Montague. But if you get some people coming in there and they get you as their docent, their tour guide, what are they going to learn about the Korean War? Give us your educational presentation here.
I will tell them how it happened. It happened on June 25th, 1950, when the North Korea maliciously invaded the South Korea, who were very weak at the time. A nation tried to survive under freedom, which we had helped them gain that freedom from the Japanese. I'll explain to them the greatness of Korea today. I saw Korea in the 50s when I was there during the war, walking in Incheon. Incheon is a very large city. It's a port city. I saw poverty of its best. I saw little kids walking down the street with no clothes on, hardly, crying, eating off of garbage cans and eating anything they could. I remember one particular day that I reached in my pocket, I gave them the change I had, and I went back to the ship because I just couldn't stand to see that kind of stuff. It was a sad deal. The great thing that brings satisfaction to me and to any Korean veteran is that I've revisited Korea twice. I was there in the year 2000, and what a change. What a change. What a nation. What we did there brought prosperity to those people. I visited last year in 2012. Today, South Korea is the 10th largest economy in the world. There is no unemployment. People are happy. There were hundreds of kids, school kids, welcoming us American veterans. I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of veterans. And let me say something here, that the United Nations fought in Korea. So the Korean government got this program that they say, revisit Korea. You pay your trip over there and your wife's, and they pay for everything else. They take care of you. But school children come in there waving American flags and singing, and it's just unbelievable. And these kids are all dressed nice and neat, uniforms. I wish that we take a lesson from them in our country here. They're all in neat uniforms, all proud of what they got. And the people are so grateful to us. Because you see, when they see one of us as an American hero, they come to you and say, thank you. Thank you for what you did. Because of what we did, they're living in freedom.
Amen. And so are we, thanks to the courage and sacrifice of men and women like our guest today, Fred Machado of Fresno, California. More of his story as we commemorate the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. We'll do that right after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 81-year-old Fred Machado of Fresno, California. Do the math on that, and you know he's a little young to have served in World War II. He didn't, but he was part of America's effort in the Korean War, and this weekend marks the 60th anniversary of the armistice that brought that forgotten war to a bit of an unsettled end. The demilitarized zone that agreement created is still there along the 38th parallel between North Korea and South Korea. Fred has been back to South Korea as recently as last year. And you were pretty impressed, Fred, weren't you, with what you found in the South?
They're enjoying life as we are. You don't see any beggars in the street. I'm kind of ashamed that I go down the street here and there's people in the corners asking for money. You don't see that in Korea. They're prosperity. They're builders. They build ships. Their economy is unbelievable. And why? Because we were there. Why did we go there? To help people gain their freedom. Not for our benefit. We didn't take $1 to our national wealth or an acre of land to our national boundaries. It's only to help people to regain what is rightfully theirs. And I did it, and I do it again today.
I believe you, and I certainly wouldn't try to stop you. When you talk about the prosperity of South Korea, I think one of the things that makes that so impressive is the stark contrast with North Korea and how opposite the situation is there. And I've talked to a lot of Korean War vets. Some people have tried to suggest at some point that there was no victory in the Korean War, or that the task wasn't finished, or it was somehow incomplete. What I hear in your voice is a whole lot of satisfaction that what you all did over there was worthwhile. At the time when that war came to an end and you had the demilitarized zone that stayed where it was and is still there today, how did you feel about it at the time? And what was the morale of your ship in particular?
I think our strong feeling was that we didn't finish the war like we should have. I had mixed feelings at the time. I thought General MacArthur was right in what he wanted to do, but I think President Truman was right when General MacArthur disobeyed his orders. I have great respect for President Truman and great respect for General MacArthur. We did okay because we preserved South Korea, but we should have preserved the whole Korean Peninsula. Yeah, there's a book out called Prisoners of the Forgotten War. I urge people to read that book because we had hundreds of prisoners of war that went through a living hell. They were starved, they were beaten, they were shot in cold blood. There's an army chaplain at that time, his name is Father Emil Capone. He was from Kansas. The Koreans killed him, finally. But he just recently was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor on, I think, April the 11th, when President Barack Obama presented the Medal of Honor to his family, 60 years after his death. But he finally got that award. But what this man did for the wounded, for the sick, for the disappointed, is unbelievable. He's got to be an angel in heaven.
Yes, Father Capon's story is incredible. He died of starvation and pneumonia after 7 months as a prisoner of war. His kindness to his fellow prisoners, legendary. He was buried in an unmarked grave, and his remains have never been located. The story goes that in Father Capon's final moments, he prayed for his captors, echoing the words of Jesus on the cross when he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Fred mentioned a book there. There's another book written by Kenneth Eaton of Clovis, California, another Korean War prisoner of war who talked about it on this program. And Ken is still making the rounds sharing his incredible story with that book. It's called Missing Dog Tags, and you can find it online. You talked about preserving freedom for the South Korean people. And I guess in the bigger picture, too, there was this worldwide battle between communist forces and, of course, the side that America was on. When you think about that big picture, and that would unfold again later in Vietnam, and you were part of the early days of that, too, but did you guys have that sense then, too, that it wasn't just Korea you were fighting for, but in a way it was the world you were fighting for?
No doubt about it. No doubt in our minds that we were fighting the big, in those days, was the Soviet Union, which finally broke up. And the Chinese, we weren't even the Chinese. We had no communications with the Chinese in those days, which was, I think, a bad situation. Our allies in the China area was Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, which is right, what we did there. But the mainland China, we had no communications with them. They were behind the North Koreans. That's what it was. Well, actually, we're fighting the Chinese. I mean, they came in by the thousands. They crossed the Yellow River. The only way we could have stopped them would have been very seriously. We could have stopped them. There's no question about it. The United States is the strongest country in the world. I want to be the strongest country in the world. I want to negotiate peace. I don't like wars. I want to negotiate out of a position of strength, not a position of fear. I'm real concerned what's happening today. Our armed forces are dwindling. You know, let me go back to the invasion of Incheon in 1950. I wasn't there, but my ship was there. But I kept up with reading what went on. There were 230 ships in that invasion, Navy ships. Plus, we had ships scattered all over the world. Today, we've got, I think, 280 ships in the Navy. That's not enough. I want Congress to wake up. We got to spend money in our national defenses. Let us be the strongest Navy in the world. Let us be the strongest nation in the world. And let us negotiate with our adversaries. But let us negotiate from a position of strength. Let us not be taking pot shots from little guys like Cuba or like Venezuela or in the Middle East now. All this stuff that's going on over there, and we're doing nothing. We're just sitting back and saying it'll be okay. It won't be okay. Some of these people have no regard for human life. And it is our duty to intervene.
You mentioned Incheon, and you weren't there for the invasion, but you were there later, and you were at Busan as well, two of the well-known spots in the Korean War. What did you witness? What did you see, and what was that like?
What I witnessed in those days was poverty and misery and the need. What we did, we would bring the troops and their equipment into these cities, and then we'd leave. I usually walked ashore a little bit. Most of us, we didn't. It's just unload our ship and get back out to sea and go somewhere else. But poverty was terrible. Everything was tore up. I mean, the buildings down. It was a mess.
And when you talk about taking troops, I'm sure the guys that you took to the beach looked a little different when you took them in compared to when you picked them up. Can you put that into words for us?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when we took them in, they were full-fledged, trained, had all their equipment. When you pick them up, some of them were wounded. Some of them had been wounded. Many of them looked weary. It was just a different story. I'll tell you what happened to me one time was my friend that tried to get me to join the Marines. And I told him, no, I'm going to go in the Navy. And one day I ran into him in Yokosuka, Japan. He was on R&R, and I would happen to be there. And I ran into him, and he was so jittery that it was unbelievable what he'd been through.
Made you kind of thankful for your experience?
Yeah. I always thank God for all these things that happened. We did our job. We did what we had to do. But they did, some of them paid the supreme sacrifice. There's a lot of young men that never lived to see the fruits of their sacrifices. This is what's sad. And if people could appreciate them today, this is what we need to do.
That's kind of why I do this show and why the museum is there, so people understand that that price has been paid, that those sacrifices were made. And if we're not aware of it, we're kind of wasting it, aren't we?
Paul, I want to congratulate you on what you do, because you're keeping this thing alive. And we need to do that, and we need to do more. We need to bring out, let the public know what our people have done. There's been a lot of sacrifices, men and women alike.
I guess one of the other things I want to ask you about, and I want to talk to you about the museum before we're done too. You served in the Korean War, and you stayed on the ship after the war in what was really, I guess, foreshadowing of where the United States forces were going to be for the next 20 years. You were in on something before America's full involvement in Vietnam, but the passage to freedom, basically moving 300,000 people from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. How did you understand what you guys were doing in 1954 on your ship?
Well, we didn't know that there was going to be a major war, of course, after that. But we knew, we learned a great deal of the history of it. Actually, most of us on the ship hadn't heard of Vietnam. The French had been there for 100 years and had been fighting the Viet Cong for 7 years. When they split the country in 1954, then they asked the U.S. for help and evacuated the refugees, anybody that wanted, they had 1 year to evacuate anybody that wanted to come from the north to the south. And likewise, the communists had the same choice. So the French asked us for help. I don't know how many ships we had there, probably, I don't know, 25 or 30 ships. And my ship happened to be one of them. We used to pick up these refugees in Haiphong, bring them to Saigon. This is what really made you say, God, how fortunate we are.
Now we hear your cell phone, too. Anchors away. That works.
So we went to that operation, Passage to Freedom. Prior to going, as soon as we found out we had to go with that evacuation, our doctor aboard ship at that time was Dr. Tom Dooley. I don't know how many of you. He became a very famous doctor later because he left the Navy and he went and established a number of hospitals in Vietnam and in Laos. He was a great guy. He spoke French fluently. He was from St. Louis, and he had studied a great deal about Vietnam, so he knew the history. And for, heck, 2 or 3 weeks before, they gave us a whole history of what Vietnam was like and what to expect. And we used to bring 2,000 refugees at a time in our ship. We had to convert. We had to leave our boats in Japan, then went to the Philippines, to Subic Bay, to rebuilt structures on a ship. We had to put these refugees in a cargo holds where we used to put the cargo, and had to build special ladders for them, special stairways for them to go down there. And then we got huge pots to cook rice, and it was a 2.5-day trip, and we fed up rice and sardines. These people, some of them were scared to death because they had been told by the communists, the propagandists, that the Americans are going to take you out to sea and dump you off in the ocean and you're going to die. Yeah, they were scared to death. But after a day with us, and we were always told don't mingle with them because these people got sicknesses. How could you stop from mingling with them? There's 2,000 in there. And little kids, and we tried to play with the little kids, tried to give the kids candy. They wouldn't take it at first, but you eat one and then give it to them, and they would eat it. And they couldn't open the cans of sardines. We'd give each one a can of sardines, so they'd come to us, and we mingled with them, and by the time, two and a half days later, we were friends. Now we took them up to Saigon, and then the Red Cross took them over from there. We made the three trips, and then we had been overseas almost 9 months, I guess, and it was time for us to come back. We were gone 11 months that time. We left here November 7th of 53 and came back in October 9th of 54. It was quite an experience there. I'll tell you, that really touched you to see these people left all their belongings behind. They had nothing but what they carried in the suitcase. And I never forgot one guy bringing a chicken in the back of his back. And of course, we could bring the chicken aboard ship, but that's all he had. These people left everything to flee the tyranny of communism. And again, it makes you think, see how fortunate am I, Lord, that I live in a free country, in a free nation.
Now, I would imagine, after everything you'd seen during the Korean War, and then to see that, and to see how desperate these people were for that little sliver of freedom, that you probably haven't taken freedom for granted since then.
No. You know, it's a precious thing to have. The thing is that they fled their homes for freedom, and on the end, they lost the whole thing because the whole country became communist. I sort of blame our politicians for what happened. All that war could have been avoided. It could have been avoided when Ho Chi Minh came to the United States and asked for help in the independence, but now we settled with the French. The French stab you in the back every time you turn around. I don't have much use for that government.
Well, and I imagine, because you, after that, you got out of the Navy, and you've told us a little bit about how you got your start out here with the rented farmland, and here you are with the Statue of Liberty out front of your property and all your almonds and raisin grapes here, and you've been married 57 years and have the family you have. But as that Vietnam War raged on, how often did you think about those 6,000 refugees you'd carried on your ship?
I thought a lot about them. I thought a lot about it. I thought about what was going on. And when I used to watch the news and see the progress, I said, my God, this thing is right. We're not doing right. It was always a fear of, we could have stopped it. There's no question about it. We had the strength. But it was the fear that maybe the Chinese were going to come in. We could have stopped them too. But then you've read Russia at that time. I'm not a politician, but had I been in Washington in charge, I think things would have been different.
Fred Machado doesn't mince words, does he? More with this Korean War veteran when we come back. The armistice that brought that war to a halt was official on July 27th, 1953, 60 years ago. There's another anniversary coming up next year that I'm going to bend your ear about in a moment. If you want to see what Fred looked like 60 years ago and what he looks like now in his front yard with his wife Maxine in front of their big Statue of Liberty, just go to Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio. We'll be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. Fred Machado served in that war in the U.S. Navy aboard the USS Montague. He serves now at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. That's in downtown Fresno, right across from the old water tower. Admission is always absolutely free. So you said you've been volunteering at the museum now for about 4 years, and I'm sure you interact with a lot of other Korean War veterans there. And since this is the 60th anniversary of the end of the war, I'd want to focus on that some more. Not that you can speak for everybody, but if it's the forgotten war, what is it that you and all these other men who served during that time think the rest of us should know and remember?
First of all, I think that we need to teach our kids in school the history of our country. I mean, not just a civil war anymore. All we teach is about the Civil War. Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf, all these wars have taken place because in all these cases, there's been tremendous sacrifices made. There's been tremendous amounts of life lost. There's been limbs lost to people that had an effect the rest of their lives. Let us remember these things. Let us talk about it. Let people know what goes on. Let people know that these freedoms that we enjoy each day didn't come easy. There's people in public life that should be there. This is my personal opinion. I think before you run for public office, you should meet a payroll of your own, and you should have served in the military. And if you haven't, you got no business in running for politics.
That would certainly narrow the field a little bit.
I believe we'd get quality then.
I've talked about the museum, and how often do you volunteer down there?
I go there twice a week, Wednesdays and Fridays, and I enjoy it, and I wish we could get more publicity, get more people in there.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do here. So it's open 10 to 3, Monday through Saturday. It's free to go in. In all the time you spent there, twice a week for 4 years, I imagine you've probably learned a lot of stuff that you didn't know before, whether from exhibits or from some of the living history, those guys that are with you walking around wearing the yellow polo shirts and the nice-looking hats. What do you think people should know about that museum and what the value of it is?
Well, I think they should know what we're preserving in there and we're preserving the history. Some of the instruments of war, those are the things that people carried with them, people had with them, that people faced every day. And anybody that came in there to our museums today, they will find veterans of World War II who went through a living hell and fight from the Korean War and from Vietnam. You'll find guys from Vietnam that were wounded, Korean War people that were wounded. I know one particular dose there that lost an eye in Korea. I just think that people need to come in there to ask questions, and we'd be tickled to that to answer them. We'll show them around anything that we can.
Do you have, other than the picture of your ship that's there, do you have a favorite exhibit, display, room, spot, photo, anything in there that the first time you saw it, you said, you know what, that's really special, and you always try to point it out for people?
Well, yes, I think we got the Prisoners of War room in there. It's got the pictures of young men, and I mean just men. I don't have any women in that one, but the one incarcerated during World War II. But that's something to see. Remember that these guys, the sacrifices that these guys went through. And then we got the Legion of Valor. You got pictures of men who went above and beyond the call of duty to do their job. And we have one particular room there that's dedicated to Gino Palesi, a Kerman fellow who unfortunately was killed 1 month before the war ended, World War II, was killed in Germany, and he's buried in Luxembourg. These are all things that are very touchy to me. Uniforms there of men and women, the nurses, we got a picture, and the history of one particular flyer in Vietnam was shot down, was captured, escaped, was captured again, and mistreated. And the history is there. We got a wonderful movie that we can show 12 minutes, all about the beginning of World War II. And these are things that are very educational. We've got a display of Navy ships there, of all the types of ships that were in World War II. Very educational. I do invite everybody to come in there and see us.
And the library you have there is pretty impressive, too. You ever spend any time just browsing around that?
I've read many books out of that library. We've got a tremendous collection of books with history of about almost anybody. You want to read about our presidents, you want to read about the dictators that caused the problems, like Hitler and Mussolini. We've got books on that. It's just a terrific library that we got there. And a lot of the history of our own military leaders.
I think one of the things that can be fun for people to do, certainly the thing that catches their eye when they get to the museum and they walk into the foyer and they see these large, blown-up versions of prestigious medals. And then underneath them are the names of all the local people who have earned those medals. Do you ever walk around that, look at the names and say, man, I wonder what the story behind that name is?
I know a lot of those guys. I know a lot of the guys. We also have a room dedicated to Pearl Harbor, and it's got the names of Pearl Harbor survivors, of which I knew some here in Fresno who were no longer with us. And their names are there. And on a Purple Heart, a bunch of names there that I know. The Silver Star, there's a bunch of names there of local guys that's still around. It's unbelievable. We got a museum that's second to none.
And I get the sense you never get tired of going down there. What do you get out of it? What's in it for you?
I get a satisfaction of, I feel like I'm still contributing a little bit to the freedoms of the United States for the things that we did. And I just get a kick out of talking to people about it when they come and ask questions about the different things and what we did. And I'm no hero. I didn't do anything extraordinary. I just did my time, and I put my life on the line like everybody else. And I swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States, to defend it, and to defend the flag against all its enemies, foreign and domestic. And I mean just that. I think I took that oath for life. And if I saw anybody today mistreat the American flag, so help me God. I won't be like some of the senators that we have that say, well, they're just expressing their freedoms. I'll show them what freedom is like.
I believe you. You know, one other question I had with regard to the Navy, and you mentioned that you saved up all your money from the Navy, and that's how you got your agricultural business started. Was there anything that you learned in the Navy, some of the things the Navy did for you or taught you, that you look back over your long career as a businessman and dairyman and farmer and say, you know what? That helped me. I got that from the Navy.
Well, when we went in, we were kids. When we came out, we were men. So that right there made you grow up. I was kind of a screwball, I might say. I had no high school diploma, no high school education, and I had an opportunity to do it in the Navy. I could have done it. Got my high school diploma. I could have gotten even the equivalent of 2 years of college, and maybe I could have got a commission. But I was 19 years old. I had lived a pretty sheltered life, and I got in the Navy. I said, this is the time to have fun. And I had my share of fun. And sometimes I think that I should have better utilized my time, but I didn't do too bad. I never got in trouble. I never got in trouble, thank the Lord. But I did have a lot of fun.
Any stories there that you want to share with us, or would you rather keep those in Davy Jones' locker?
I think we better keep those buried. I enjoyed traveling in the Navy. We went to not only to Korea, but I went to Hong Kong, to the Philippines, to Vietnam, all over Japan. These are things that, you know, in those days, when you were a kid, Japan, that's a million miles away. How would you get there? Korea? Most people hadn't heard of Korea until the war broke out. I well remember the day that it broke out was a Sunday, June 25th. And I had gone, my family, we had all gone to Merced to see my aunt. And coming back, I heard on the radio that the war had broke out in Korea. I didn't have a clue where Korea was. That's something you never forget. And the day the armistice was signed, we were here in the United States. And we went back overseas shortly after, but we were here. See, in 1953, we left here on November 7th. But prior to that, we had gone to Hawaii in May and spent 30 days in Hawaii, a whole fleet of ships practicing landings, landing troops, and I believe was the 1st Army Division that we picked up at Fort Lewis, Washington, and we landed them in the island of Molokai. They were there for 3 or 4 days. Then we pick them up. Then we will land them in Kauai. Then we pick them up again. They go do their army maneuvers, and we go back to sea. Then we'll come back and pick them up in those boats. We went to the Big Island, to Hilo, for a couple of days of recreation because we hadn't had any recreation. This was a work all the time. Then we got a call that the 3rd Marine Division had to go to the Far East. So they were in Camp Pendleton. And we loaded them in San Diego. They'd come down, and it took us probably a week to load all. I don't know how many ships. It must have been 50 ships. A Marine division is 25,000 men. And their equipment, we sailed out of San Diego Bay. I never forgot that day. one ship behind the other is like cars down the freeway. Until we get out to the open sea, then you form the convoy. So you have the ships that carry the troops and the cargo. Then you had the escorts. You had carriers, cruisers, submarines, and destroyers that follow us to protect us in case there was an attack of the enemy. So these are pictures that I have in my mind that I was a young man and enjoyed that and was proud of what we were doing.
Well, when you look back on it all now, 60 years later, and there's no doubt in my mind, you're proud of being in the Navy. I can hear that. All our listeners can. And I know you're thankful for your family and everything else. What would you say, though, in reflecting that you are most proud of, that just gives you the best feeling after all these years?
Oh, I guess the fact that I live in this blessed country, that we've been able to do the things that you want to do. I chose my own way of life. That I married a wonderful woman. That we raised three wonderful children. Now we have six grandchildren. And the opportunities that they have, this just makes me proud as heck of everything we did, of our great country, and all that we have. And each day, believe you me, each day, I thank God. I never forgot. I thank God for all that we have, because only Him can give us these things.
Amen. And I guess I've got to ask you, since you've been married 57 years, you got any secrets you can share with the rest of us that want to be able to say that someday?
I'll tell you what, marriage is give and take. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, I've never been mad at my wife to where I couldn't say goodnight. I have. So let's be truthful. But we all got faults, and we just overcome them, and that's all there is to it. I wouldn't trade my life or my family for nothing in this world. It's been great.
And you're 81 years old. Most people wouldn't think that looking at you or shaking your hand. But I guess I've got to ask you, how long are you going to keep working at the museum?
Oh, as long as I can. I like it. It's not something, if you have something to do that you have to do with your family or something, you can take off. But other than that, hell, I go. I got a son and a son-in-law that take care of our business. And I'm just here for the heck of it. I enjoy it. I get up at 5 o'clock every day. I go make coffee in the shop so the guys can have coffee when they come to work. We got some other employees. We got about 5 employees besides our own family. It's just a great life. I just absolutely love this farm life.
And I guess if you want to be the oldest guy working at the museum, you're going to have to keep going for quite a while, huh?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of them a lot older than I. That's right. That's right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of them a lot older than I. That's right. That's right. So, yeah, but we're doing good. You know, we got guys there that's 90 years old, 92 years old, in fact. So, and they're in good shape. Yeah. And they're guys that fought in World War through hell. A lot of them did.
I guess the other thing I have to ask you is your Statue of Liberty out front of your property here. How long have you had that, and what's the story behind it?
I probably had that for 20 years or more. I've been to the Statue of Liberty in New York, and I think it's a great sign, a great thing to see. And one day I was going down to McKinley Avenue, and I saw a Statue of Liberty there, and it was for sale. So I stopped. There was a place where they sell fountains, the art fountains and things like that. I said, yeah, it's for sale, so I bought it. And I brought it over here, and I had that stand built. And I've always flew the flag probably all my life, because I'm proud of that flag.
Well, Fred, I just want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for what you're doing at the museum and for telling us all about it. Is there anything else I haven't asked you about you think I ought to know?
Like I told you in the beginning, I know there's a lot of guys who did a lot more in Korea than I did on land. Those are the guys that went through living hell.
Well, and we remember them on this 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. We especially remember the more than 50,000 Americans who died in the Korean War. We're out of time today, but after listening to Fred and his unmistakable love for our country, I think you've got this down. I'll remind you anyway, freedom is not free.